Thank you, everyone. I know there's absolutely nothing better to do at 9 o'clock on Saturday night in New York than come to a talk about patents. So I'm an attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. My full title is Senior Staff Attorney and Mark Cuban Chair to Eliminate Stupid Patents. That is actually my job title. Mark Cuban supports our patent work, even though he doesn't agree with everything EFF does. He also thinks there are a lot of stupid patents. We do a variety of things on patent policy. We litigate, we've challenged patents, we challenged a software patent on podcasting that had been used to threaten podcasters and actually got that patent invalidated and ended up going all the way to petitioning an appeal on the Supreme Court, which we won about 3 or 4 weeks ago now. Thank you. We also do regulatory submissions. We blog, and we go to Congress and try and get them to either do good things or not do bad things. And I'll get to some of that towards the end of this talk. But this talk is really going to focus on a series we have, the Stupid Patent of the Month, that we have to highlight problems with software patents. There are a lot of problems with the Patent Office that we will start to get into in more detail. And it's been kind of an educational process. It's good for us to have the discipline to write every week. And we focus on software patents, which is what, because of the sort of digital mission of EFF. But before we get to software patents, I wanted to share with you some of my very favorite stupid patents. So let's go to the method of swinging on a swing. This is not a joke. This is a real patent that issued. It was filed for in 2002. It was filed by the child of a patent prosecutor who had a kid who was very excited about finding a new way to swing side to side on a regular swing, and helped his kid file this patent application. It was issued. They got a lot of bad press. I mean, really, like, what? Like, it's kind of a silly patent. But not a software patent, but still, you know, what? So this is one of my personal favorites. The user-operated amusement apparatus for kicking the user's buttocks. This was, you might think, like it's amusing, like, hey, you know, this is a real machine. Maybe this isn't that stupid a patent. But I still think, really, no matter how deep into the sort of what of the patent system, that there's always more sort of what to be had. And like, I've shown this patent at talks before, and someone came up to me and said, you know, there's one of these on a road in South Carolina between, you know, some town on the beach. It's like a tourist thing. And I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I wonder if it's like the actual patentee. And I looked into it, and it's a machine that this was on the road in New Bern. It's from 1937. And, you know, this is a patent that was issued in 2000. So, you know, there were only, like, what, 63 years after the machine existed, someone decided to patent it, which, you know, shows that the Patent Office is not always the best at finding prior art. You know, sometimes they allow patents on things that already exist. This is a real. This is a real patent drawing, a patent name. And you may think, well, you know, maybe the claims are a little different. You know, in patent law, the claim at the end of the patent is really the big important thing. This is, you know, like it's a particular. Maybe it's on a particular kind of brick made to build a pyramid. No, it's really like you read the claims, and there's a bit of patentees and a bit of you know, sort of pretend. Pretend complexity to it, but it's really a patent on burying human remains in a pyramid. And you know, if you think the patent system is supposed to be on something new, you know, is anyone in this room aware of prior art on this patent? But you know, like what is the Patent Office doing? Like really? Like if you what was the examiner like doing? And that, and you know, like I just don't know. Anyway, So turning to our beloved software patents, you know, that we come to the first question, which is, you know, what is a software patent? It's not really a clear definition of what a software patent is. It's certainly not software. Like, you sometimes you see pseudocode in a software patent, but you very rarely see lines of actual code. Sometimes you'll see like a little snippet here and there, but generally it's like if you're at an organization and you have a problem and you need to solve it with software, and you meet and you say, well, what are we going to do about this? The software patent is the thing that happens in the first 1 minute of that meeting. It's like, well, you know, we're going to need this or that structure, we're going to need a server, and like, you know, all the hard work. It's just basically do a thing with a computer. If you look at software patents, there'll often be flowcharts, there'll be discussions of, you know, using a processor and memory and like at that level of generality. And you know, if anyone who actually programs for a living will like, yeah, you know, I do in fact use processors as part of this. This is not particularly inventive to tell me to apply processing and memory to solve a problem with software. So why do we care about software patents? Like when the sort of my opposite numbers, the people who argue vehemently in favor of software patents, so the kind of people from companies like IBM or the intellectual property owners organization, when they talk about patents, they'll say, well, you know, if there are no patents, then anyone can just steal your work, and that's terrible, and there'll be no incentive to innovate. And you know, that's not really true, because the patent system is not about copying. Copying is not an element of patent infringement. If you write a program and you release it, and then someone sends you a letter saying, I have a patent on, let me see, what's one of my favorite, you know, on using a computer to send notifications, and your app has notifications, and you've never heard of this person, you've never read this patent, they're completely unknown in the community, they had nothing to do with any of the operating system, hardware, anything to do with your app, that does not matter. It doesn't matter at all. The question is, do you infringe, which is a patent, there's the claims at the end, it has I claim X, Y, and Z. Do you do X, Y, and Z, and then is the patent valid? And then that's a question of, was it new? And at the patent office, that often means really, you know, did someone else patent it before? Because as we'll talk about in more detail as we discuss some of these patents, the patent office is not great at looking at prior art, which is stuff that happened before you applied. Prior art can be written, it can be publications, but it can also be things that are on sale. So anything that's in the App Store, on GitHub, and some kind of open source project, whatever, if it's available publicly, it's prior art. But very, very little of that prior art is getting through filtering in any meaningful way to the patent office. And so you get these patents where they're really broad, they're from people who didn't contribute in any meaningful way to what's being done in the real world, and they're being asserted against people who are contributors, are writing original software. And in this sense, it's very different from copyright. Copyright, there are debates and questions about how broad copyright should be on software. You can talk about Google v. Oracle and APIs and reverse engineering. There's issues, but at the end of the day, like if you copy a huge amount of code, you're probably infringing someone's copyright, and it's right there in the name of the legal right, copying. And if you do it with permission, and that permission may be a software license, particularly like in the free license world, you get something, it's a free software project, you fork it, you contribute to it, whatever, you're operating within this zone of permission and creativity, and you can't be then sued by the person who wrote the kernel or whatever 10 years ago because they've licensed it to the world under these terms. The problem with patents is someone comes in from outside who has nothing to do with anything, with a piece of paper, and says, all right, now you owe me money. Now you can't do what you want to do. So let's get to some stupid patents. Don't worry too much about reading the little text, but we had one of our very first stupid patents of the month was from a patent assertion entity called Blue Spike that has a number of patents. Basically, they're on fingerprinting. And they've been very active. They've sued a number of companies with mixed success. The patent that was the subject of this article eventually got invalidated, and that was upheld on appeal. But they still have other patents in the family and other patents, and they're still actually suing companies. And they were very salty about this article. I got a lot of hate on Twitter from friends of the inventor who were extremely outraged that someone would critique this brilliant genius who suggested using reference generators, feature selectors, comparing devices, and recorders, like, you could do it with software. You know, you could do it with hardware, you could do it, I don't know, with like water molecules, but you could do it with software. So now he like owns this idea in his mind for thing. And this kind of highlights a recurring problem with software patents in that software patents often involve claims that are very, very functional. It's like, do a thing with a computer, you know, have a comparing device or notifications or you know, whatever. And there's sort of the patent office doesn't really have a good sense of what's amazingly easy and what's hard. And so they'll give patents that kind of have both problems in that you'll get a patent on something that's just mind-numbingly mundane. Like, you know, sending in a second, we'll get to a out-of-office email patent. And then you'll get patents on quite challenging things, but the patent doesn't actually tell you how to do it. It just says, you know, use a bunch of structures, use some memory, use a processor, and do it with software, and good luck to you. And, you know, so people are claiming broadly. They're claiming really, really obvious ideas. They're claiming broadly. They're claiming basically the solution. This is the problem with software patents, particularly as people get to claim they claim the problem rather than the solution, rather than this is how I'm going to solve it this particular way. They're like, solving this problem X with software is my patent. And that, so another one we did, we wrote up, when was this? This was early last year, IBM patent. I found this just trawling the Gazette. So every Tuesday, there are about 300,000 patents issued every year. So if you check, I think it's about 6,000 a week get issued, something like that. We find stupid patents of the month in a variety of ways. We look to things that are being asserted in trolling campaigns. We look for, people send them to us by email. But sometimes I just go and read the Gazette. It comes out every Tuesday. If you know the classification system, you can kind of know where the garbage tends to cluster. And I'll just go and spend, you know, a morning clicking through 200 or 300 patents to find something really dumb and make fun of IBM. So I just found the Gazette. It's the title is like, out of office email. And the patent, in fairness to IBM, so, you know, this was issued last year. I wrote about it right after it was issued. In fairness to IBM, it wasn't just the idea of out-of-office email. There was a little tweak, and the tweak was that you could set up your out-of-office email so that it would start sending the message like a couple of days before you went on vacation. So it would say, I will be out of the office next week. You know, if this is a major project, you know, wait till maybe you can wait, or, you know, whatever you want. But like from a technical perspective, like this is not inventive. This is just clicking, this is just adjusting settings in software that, if it doesn't already exist, is extremely mundane and extremely easy to write. I often give the example that if you invented a car, you wouldn't give someone a patent for the idea of driving the car before 8 a.m. on Sunday, because obviously you can drive a car at 8, but like that, well, that's just ridiculous. But you do see software patents that are basically like that. They're like, one of our stupid patents of the month, it's not up in this presentation, but it's on updating computer game software to update, like if you have a game that's like the NFL or whatever, and a stadium changes, maybe a team moves stadium, you update the game so that the graphics of the stadium is new. And it's just a patent on updating software. Like, there's nothing in the patent that explains, that solves any new technical problems. It's just like, people have been updating software, and over the internet, of course. People have been updating software over the internet for a little while now, but, you know, this is a patent that was issued, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, and it was asserted. It was sued, EA got sued, and a bunch of other companies got sued with it. And one of the big problems here is, like, you're thinking, well, out-of-office email, you know, have I heard it? Does that ring a bell? Is it something that exists? You know, here is a drawing from the patent, and this is, you know, the patent was filed, I forget the priority date, but it's recent. It's like a 2010s patent application. And, you know, this is a 1998 screen cap from Notes. Like, you think maybe the examiner should be looking at you. If we assume that software patents are a thing that should exist, that the examiner should at least look at some software. But this patent was examined, and on a patent they'll show there's a list of references considered by the examiner. They're all patents. Like, you're talking about out-of-office email, and the patent office isn't looking at any software at all. It's only other patents. So this is particularly punishing for the free software world, where people have philosophical objections to patents, so they're not filing them. And it's like a $40,000, you know, filing a patent, paying the lawyer, all of that is like a $40,000 project to get it in. And that's a really expensive way to create prior art. It's not prior art. If you publish it online, you put it on GitHub or whatever, that's prior art. But the patent office will only look at it if it's a patent, and you're not going to spend $40,000 to file a patent in the hope that one day some examiner is going to look at it. Fortunately, IBM was sufficiently shamed by the media coverage of this patent that they actually disclaimed it, I was quite surprised by. I would have thought they would just ignore us. I mean, that's what I would do if I was their PR person. Which means they file a form with the patent office that says this is now dedicated to the public. So I can give you all the good news that if you want to write an out-of-office email client that sends the out-of-office email a day or two early, you can now do that without infringing a patent. So that's how IBM reacted. IBM, you know, kind of figured, well, we'll head this off at the pass. We'll accept a little bad press and give the patent to the public. That has unfortunately not been our experience with all of these posts. A lot of the patents we write about are by what are informally called patent trolls, companies that assert patents sort of as their business model. There's, you know, no clear definition of patent troll, but, you know, in our view, if asserting a patent is your main game, then we think that's pretty trolly. But the problem with patent trolls is, you know, if your main game is litigating, then, you know, if you you start to see every problem as a litigation problem, and so getting criticism maybe is also a litigation problem. So 2015, we wrote about a company called Eclipse IP. They changed their name, I suspect, to get out from the Google results. They're now called, Electronic Technologies LLC. Something extremely mundane, something very hard to Google. And this was a patent on a kind of notification. There are a lot of patents on just little tweaks to notifications, little tweaks to geolocation, like pretty much any kind of thing you do with an app. There's just this huge cluster of patents on any kind of small modification to the feature you can think of. The inventor in this case is a patent lawyer, and that's not uncommon with a lot of trolley patents. There was a guy that sued Twitter for asserting a patent on having a social network, but with famous people. And he later, full disclosure, my firm represented Twitter in that case. He later, in deposition, admitted he had never written a line of code. He thought of the patent in half an hour, and for half an hour's work, social network of famous people. There are famous people on Twitter. Twitter infringes. That went all the way to a jury. The judge didn't grant summary judgment. So Without being specific, going to a jury is expensive. It's very, very common in patent litigation that will cost more than $1 million. Someone spends half an hour, a patent lawyer spends half an hour thinking about something that costs you $1 million, not super fair in our view. Anyway, turning back to this patent lawyer, we wrote about this case. Eclipse IP had filed a number of lawsuits with this patents in the same family. This was a new patent that issued from the family that had been asserted very widely. And we were annoyed because other patents in the family had been found invalid. And this was under I'm going to talk in more detail about Alice v. CLS Bank, this decision from the Supreme Court that says you can't have an abstract software patent where it's an abstract idea on a generic computer. Came down in 2014, has been really good for a lot of these really, really low value software patents have been thrown out. And we were concerned that the patent office had issued more patents in the same family, even though others were being thrown out. They hadn't disclosed this to the patent office at the time. We called them out, but it started to get interesting after that. So the inventor, the lawyer, Scott Hostemeyer, sued me personally, sued EFF, and I was pretty mad. His lawyer's name was Sanford Asman, goes by Sandy, and he had already been in the news for a trademark threat against a startup, and Ars Technica people had been kind of getting stuck into him on the comments, and I will fully admit that these comments were pretty immature. Sandy Asman, people had been modifying that very slightly. But we fortunately found a law firm that represented us for free, and we sent them a very detailed letter explaining that our speech was protected by the First Amendment. One of the disputes was they were very upset that we had complained that the patent office hadn't been told about this court decision, and they were like, there is no ethical duty to tell the patent office about a court decision. This ethical duty to disclose prior art that you know only applies to actual prior art, like journal articles and so on, but the actual manual for patent examination and procedure and federal circuit law is extremely clear. Like, there are decisions directly on point that is not the case. You do have to disclose legal decisions that are material. And which was pretty ironic because part of their criticism was that I'm not a patent prosecutor, I'm not a member of the patent bar. And so they were like, you don't know anything about anything, we know all about patent prosecution, and their lead complaint was 100% wrong. Anyway, so we wrote back, we said we were really not gonna give in. They got some pretty negative press. And they abandoned the case 3 days after they served it, which was a wise decision. It was a really, really foolish lawsuit, in my view. They are entitled to disagree with our opinions, but they cannot use the courts to censor us. So on that topic, courts trying to censor, I will turn to another stupid patent of the month. This is a patent owned by an Australian company called Global Equity Management SA. And it's basically, speaking very, very broadly and loosely, it's on a GUI of managing different operating systems, managing storage in different operating systems, virtualization. And so you have virtual cabinets, you have a thing to click on, blah, blah, blah. I didn't think it was a very good patent. The inventor disagrees. He is entitled to that view. But, I think I'm well within my rights to criticize the patent. But we got a kind of a nasty gram about it. And so this is from an Australian lawyer, so I'll read it in my best Australian accent. All right. Demand of apology for slander and defamatory statements. Does anyone know what defamatory means? I'm not sure if that's a legal term of art that I'm not familiar with. We have been consulted by Global Equity Management SA Proprietary Limited, here and after referred to as our client, to write you in relation to the defamatory, false and malicious slander which you and the Electronic Frontier Foundation made concerning our client on EFF.org at a website that's not EFF.org in the attached article. The said statement was made available to the viewing of the worldwide public with the intention of portraying our client's intellectual property as stupid. Guilty. In addition to numerous other malicious lies and misleading statements about the 400 patent owned by our client. And they actually filed a lawsuit in the Supreme Court of South Australia. And they got an injunction. They got a preliminary injunction, which they served on EFF, asking us to take down the article and to never talk about their intellectual property again. That's really not how it works in the United States. Unfortunately, there is a law called the Speech Act, and I forget some god-awful acronym, as these things usually are, that allows you to go to court to sue to have a foreign order declared unenforceable if it's contrary to the First Amendment. And it's basically a law against libel tourism. So you can't just go to Australia or the United Kingdom, get a judgment against a United States organization like EFF and enforce it in US courts. And so we sued them in the Northern District of California federal court here. They never appeared, even though they actually were litigating patent cases in the same district, literally in the courtroom down the hall. We won. We got a great judgment explaining why our article was protected by the First Amendment and why an injunction asking us to take it down and not speaking about their... I mean, that... For a First Amendment lawyer, an injunction telling you not to speak about an entire topic ever again is just, you know, that is just so far outside what is contemplatable in US law. Just sort of as a coda to all this, their patent got thrown out. It's so sad. The Patent Trial and Appeal Board, which is a body within the Patent Office, ended up finding this patent invalid. I think the prior art was, there was Partition Magic. Partition Magic was the prior art. These are kind of a distraction. We don't want to have to deal with these lawsuits. We just want to be able to express our views. But fortunately, the First Amendment has come through for us. First, I think the first case was dismissed because, speculating obviously, but that the lawyer saw sense that it was, you know, however much he might disagree with us, that was not going to be a successful suit, and it was not going to be any fun either, at least for him. And that then with the Australian suit, then the Speech Act and the First Amendment really came through for us. So anyway, turning from stupid patent of the month, I want to get to sort of some big picture patent policy stuff, and this is going to just quickly go through, mostly talking about ALICE, this decision from 2014 about software patents. But before that, give you this super quick idea about some of the things that have happened in the last 10 or so years. And it's generally been pretty good. I mean, the patent system is still very, very flawed in our view, and it still interferes with free software in ways that it should not. But there have been a lot of good things. eBay is a decision from 2006 that is really quite a major decision in that it used to be routine that if you won a patent case, you got an injunction stopping the other person from doing
selling or distributing or whatever. And sort of in the around this time, Research in Motion got sued on a software patent relating to the BlackBerry, and they were looking at an injunction preventing the sales of BlackBerries, and they ended up paying $650 million to that patent owner. And that pressure of the injunction is really kind of what drove that, I think. And so it's quite a while ago now, but without it, the world would be even crazier. Case IV Telefax made it obviousness, made it a little bit easier to show something is obvious based on prior art. The Federal Circuit, which is the court below the Supreme Court that hears patent cases, is kind of, even though they're not supposed to, is kind of undone it in a lot of ways. The American Invents Act was a law in 2011. Created new processes at the patent office to challenge patents has been much more successful, in my view, than expected, much more bad for the people on the other side than they expected, I think. So that's how we challenged this patent on podcasting I mentioned at the start of the talk. And similarly, that's how the patent on virtual cabinets got invalidated. Octane makes it easier to get shift fees. That has been used in some pretty abusive trial cases and I think is a deterrent. Alice v. CLS Bank, we'll get to that in a moment. It's a big one. And then TC Heartland is a case about venue. It's very in the weeds on law, but it's about interpreting the statute that tells you which federal court you can file in. Previously, many of you might have even heard of this because it got so out of whack, it was even on like John Oliver, that the Eastern District of Texas, particularly the courthouse in Marshall, was totally dominating patent litigation. At one point, more than 1,000 cases were before one judge in Marshall. That was about 25% of all patent litigation in the country, which is completely nuts, and in our view was really fueled by that court having a lot of local rules that tilted the playing field, and that's how they attracted this business. It was a pretty small town. It was very lucrative for a lot of the restaurants, printers, whatnot. And I've heard Eastern District Texas lawyers openly talk about the judges that started to bring this as rainmakers. You know, it is really not the job of a federal judge to be a rainmaker for a town. But it was pretty shameless. And it's still a problem. International companies can still be sued in any district. So if you're Samsung, you're still going to enjoy the barbecue down in Marshall. But it's gone from about 25. It's gone from, at its peak, I think it got to about 35 or 45. Anyway, it was a lot. It was like at least a third of patent suits were being filed in EDTex, and now it's back down to about 10%, which is still crazy, but it's not as crazy. So Alice, our friend Alice, it's a great graphic by Hugh Dandre, who works at EFF. Alice is a decision. It came out of a case that was basically on a patent on sort of settlement of if you have two parties, you want to get one money to the other, but there's trust issues. You use Bitcoin, of course. No, you use a trusted third party, and it was basically a patent on the idea of using a trusted third party, but with a computer, of course. Went up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said Section 101 of the Patent Act, which is basically what's patentable. You can't patent an idea. You can't patent something that already exists in nature. It has to be a new and useful machine or transformation. They said under the statute, you can't patent an abstract idea that is implemented on a generic computer. You can't just say, do a thing, do it. Here's a good idea, do it on a computer. It is not the death of all software patents, particularly the Federal Circuit has, there's a few cases from the Federal Circuit really pushing back against the idea that it's the death of all software patents. But it has been the death of a certain kind of software patent, and a lot of them were really the worst. The kind of patents that were being asserted against 500 companies at once, that were on, voting online or tracking a vehicle, really, really broad patents. A lot of them got thrown out. So It's been a really excellent decision. It's been a lot of backlash against it. Judge Moore is a judge on the Federal Circuit around the time of that, before it got to the Supreme Court, where, you know, basically writing for the Supreme Court in her dissent, she said that a decision invalidating the claims would decimate the electronic and software industries. And I'm sorry to say she was correct. No software has been written since June 2014. Manny Schechter, Chief Patent Counsel, IBM, Patents Promote Innovation, Al's decision and its progeny, reducing innovation. You see, it might be a missing step somewhere in there. Legislation is needed so that America continues to be a worldwide innovation leader. And this is the folks we fight with in the public policy world. They have this completely unexamined assumption that patents always promote innovation. This, if you weaken patents, and Alice in some ways weakens patents, it makes it harder to get patents, that this is gonna hurt innovation. R&D and software has gone up. It went up much more in 2015 than it did in 2014. It's completely divorced from reality as a view, but it is a view that is extremely strongly held. It is a religion from the patent people. So the Intellectual Property Owners Association is proposing legislation. This is the language, 101B now. The only exception to subject matter eligibility, if it basically already existed in nature or exists solely in the human mind. And so to give you an idea of what that would mean, right now we have a client who is being threatened by Hodder & Stoughton, a UK publisher. He releases language lessons online, and Hodder & Stoughton claim to be the licensee of a patent that is having language lessons on a recorded medium in a certain order. It's a really, really banal order. It's basically having question and answer on a recorded medium. But that would satisfy this. It's a tape. A tape is a physical thing. It doesn't exist solely in the human mind. So that would make that, at least under 101, it would be eligible. You would still have to satisfy obviousness and whatnot, but we've seen kind of what a great job the Patent Office does of that. And if the Patent Office finds itself getting patents on language lessons on tape where the language is structured in a certain way, like, it has to go and find language lessons structured in that way to deny the patent if this becomes the law, which is really, really nuts. So we have this Saved by Alice project where it's up at EFF.org, Alice, where we tell a bunch of stories about companies that have managed to use the Alice decision to defend themselves against threats from really, really stupid patents. And we're sort of preparing to fight back because there are IBM, the Intellectual Property Owners Organization, the AIPLA, which is the Intellectual Property Lawyers, and a bunch of other organizations are really trying to pressure Congress. Nothing has been formally introduced that's going anywhere yet. There's a bill in the House that's been introduced by someone that's not even on the right committee, so it's not really going anywhere, but the Senator Coons in the Senate is on the intellectual property, on judiciary, and which has intellectual property jurisdiction, and he, I think, would be likely to, you know, willing to introduce something like this. So we're going to be looking for people who actually write software and know about software and care about software to be ready to kind of counter messages on this. And you may see early next year us doing call outs for people to call Congress or do visits. I went to Congress to the Hill in June and did some visits with staffers to sort of tell them that, you know, the sky has not fallen since the Alice decision. IBM got 9,000 patents last year. It doesn't need to get 20,000. This is everything is going to be fine. But it's mostly, you know, from apps. This is defense. There is not a move to abolish all software patents in Congress. There's not a lot of momentum for that. I think, you know, that's a long-term battle that this Stupid Patent of the Month series is, and our work is part of, but for the moment, we're really trying to defend Alice. And with that, I think we can go to questions. I think there's a microphone here.
For the open source community.
Sorry?
For the open source community.
Yes.
Is there, what sort of protections does one have when one unintentionally infringes on one of these esoteric gotcha type patents if you're not selling the product?
Yep.
What can they do to you?
So unfortunately, if you're, there's really, I can't give you a particularly satisfying answer. There is a difference. If you've never heard of the patent, there is, you are at higher risk for willful infringement, where there's theoretically treble damages are available at the judge's discretion in cases of willful infringement. The thing about willful infringement is, though, is that you don't get there unless you've gone through the whole litigation and lost. And, you know, so by that point, you know, you're already out so much money on the litigation. It's, but from, you know, you can try and document your code well so that it's easy for people to find, so they can take, they can defend themselves by showing it as prior art. You can, but unfortunately the problem is, because they come so much from outside the community, there's if the patent were found valid and you know you infringe, you could, you know, you're that's enough. I mean, hopefully with Alice, that will give you a good defense against a lot of the kind of patents that the open source community would be worried about. But a lot of that's sort of still in flux. The Federal Circuit's still grappling with what Alice means, and so it doesn't provide like sort of a complete software patents are dead comfort.
You've got to be the microphone. If it's from an open source, you really shouldn't have to worry too much about the intent. There's really not much willfulness that you can, you know, infuse into an open source discovery. Yeah. And so I think you are relatively safe.
Well, yeah, on willfulness, but on infringement, it doesn't matter if the intent is irrelevant.
Well, in terms of punitive damages, it is very important.
Yeah, I think for a lot of open source projects, the cost of patent litigation itself would demolish them.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, that's my opinion. I think you're in good shape.
Hi. So sure. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the Australian lawsuit that you mentioned.
Yeah.
I guess I have a few questions that are sort of around that theme. Like, one of them is, you know, did the EFF actually try to challenge the Australian court case, and where did that go? And also, like, are you personally banned from Australia, or would you get arrested if you or served if you showed up in Australia?
Yeah. I mean, I wish. Australia sucks.
Wow.
EFF didn't appear, and I honestly don't know what happened. They served us with a preliminary injunction, and they either gave up or we don't know. They never served us with anything else. They never properly served us with the moving papers either, so it was a pretty half-assed effort.
Okay.
Hey, so first off, thank you for all of the hard work you do protecting developers. I am a developer / product owner, and I am responsible for, you know, a team of 6 other people, very small. But, you know, I love my project, and I want it to last. So when my client comes to me and says, my investors want to give me $1 million if I have 10 software patents.
Yeah.
What do I do?
Yeah, I'm not too judgmental on these kind of things. I think, you know, I personally think software patents are bad for the world, and that it's better if we don't get them, but I understand that people operate in the world that exists. You know, you may not want to pay taxes to fund wars, but, you know, that's the law, and, you know, the alternative is going to jail. It's not with patents. I think you can. In most pure software companies that are either software as a service or selling software are fairly patent light. Most software patents come, like, the real volume comes from the giants, So, you know, I've been making fun of IBM, but, you know, there are other, Google gets like 3,000 patents a year. Microsoft gets 4,000 or 5,000 a year. There are some venture people that care about patents and prefer patents there. It's certainly not all. And on software patents, it's a quite mixed view. There's been some empirical research on this, asking venture capitalists what they think of software patents, and those that do care, even those that care, often it's not that they really think the software patent is going to do you as a company any good. It's just going to be there'll be something left in the jar if it all goes belly up, and that's, you know, that's as a founder, that's really not very little comfort. I think with sometimes I get similar questions from people who are at the bigger companies where they're pressured to apply and help the patent lawyers apply, and say, like, you know, like, you got to do your job. But you know, if they do start to write ridiculously broad claims, or they're trying to patent stuff that you know was done 5 years ago, like, push back. You know, don't let them get away with it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Good evening. Do you have a position on what might be characterized as standards essential patents? You know, like, I write a lot of software, like, in the digital TV space, and you know, the FCC has laws that say you must conform with these standards, but these standards have patents that come along with them in order to implement them.
Yeah, we haven't done a ton of work on standard essential patents in the last few years. It's been just, you know, so many other issues bubbling. But we definitely are on the lookout for cases where there's abuse, where people, you know, so you might have heard of RAND, of reasonable and non-discriminatory royalties, and some companies take very different views of their obligations when they have RAND obligations in for standards. And it is unfortunately part of why some companies want to get patents, so they have a little bit of a little bit more leverage in when standards are being developed. It is particularly frustrating when good standards aren't created because of patent risk and patent worries from bad actors. But, you know, and it's particularly terrible when people do follow standards, because, you know, it's a standard, you have 80-11 or whatever, and then someone jumps out from under a rock and says, I have a patent that covers this standard, and everyone and their dog can get sued. It's good to sort of have it brought up, because it is actually an area that we want to think about more and do more work in. All right, we got about 2 minutes, so we definitely have time for a question. If anyone else? Oh, yep, someone coming up.
Our local paper, The Village Voice, had a whole issue more than 10 years ago devoted to how demoralized the whole patent office was, that the patent examiners were discouraged, poorly paid, understaffed, and it was basically a tragic mess. Is that your sense of what's going on there now?
Yeah, I mean, we try not to make too much, like, fun of the examiners, and if you... They don't have enough time. The average per patent application from when it was first filed to when claims issue is 22 hours of examiner time. And only, you know, maybe half of that is on looking for prior art. So you can understand why they're looking at patents. That's much more accessible to them. They're not gonna, you know, getting onto GitHub and starting looking at software projects there is gonna be way more work and take way longer, and they don't have that time. So the system is just not set up to really do a good job, and unfortunately, you see that particularly in areas that are patent light. There's so much non-patent art, like software, and it varies. There's actually some really kind of disturbing research that patent examiners that progress and stay there longer and get promoted they get less and less time to do it, which, you know, usually would make sense. Like you're getting better at your job, you're supposed to do things quicker, but they're already given so little. And it's very clear that the examiners that get to stay become rubber stamps, and they have more obviousness findings of litigated patents. If the examiner was more senior, it's more likely the patent will be found invalid in court if it's challenged, which is exactly the opposite of what you would want to see if it was kind of a function, if it was, you know, if the system was set up well. And with that, I will end it. Thanks for coming out.